Hi, my name is Lucanyo Mnyanda. I'm the editor of Business Day in Johannesburg. I'm sitting here with Warren Thompson, our senior financial writer. Warren, it's been quite a big week for South Africa, the country that's still trying to come to terms with the past decade of the Zuma years and wrangling all these things from the private and the state sector. But we want to concentrate on the private sector. I mean, you've written the stories about resilient, and you've been working on Steinhoff. What kind of week has it been this week? How would you wrap up what's been happening, starting with that letter from those fund managers? And how important was that letter from fund managers demanding the investigations into what happened at Resilient? And maybe you can tell the listeners what actually happened at Resilient as well.
Yes, Lucania, I think it's certainly been interesting, and I think in many ways, as you've mentioned, what the country is going through at the moment is almost like the hangover of the Zuma era. And not just in the public sector, where we've seen the commencement of all the commissions of inquiry, the Zondo Commission of Inquiry into State Capture, the Nugent Commission into the affairs at SARS. But certainly what we're seeing is many of the crimes, if you can call it that, that were being committed in the Zuma era were also happening in the private sector. And so that letter that you've mentioned regarding the resilient group of companies that was written by a collection of our biggest institutional investors, led by the Public Investment Corporation, which manages the money for the government employees, nearly 2 trillion rand there, but also household names that many of us have financial products with, and certainly happy to provide savings to these stewards of our capital to look after. That included like the likes of Allan Gray and Coronation, Prudential, Old Mutual. They came out and wrote this letter this week that asked the resilient group of companies to definitively resolve many of the allegations that had been made against the companies over a period for as long as a decade. And that was unprecedented because some of the institutions were not had little or no shareholding in the companies, and it's the first time certainly that we, myself and I think you as well, have seen a letter of this nature asking a company to institute a forensic investigation without any limits to the scope, conducted by a top four audit company. And with the ability to investigate anything that they deem untoward during the course of their investigation as well. So, a very strong statement, and part, I think, of the storytelling that the Business Day has provided around this is that this is in large part due to what's been going on in our society, and certainly in the wake of Steinhoff, asset managers have felt it their responsibility now. Given that some of the safeguards in place have not worked, to really impress upon South African corporate South Africa that corporate governance needs to be paid attention, needs to be front and center in terms of the way our companies are run.
Just for somebody who doesn't have the background or on resilient, can you just like take us a bit of a step back? What is resilient, and what is actually alleged to have happened here, and also what will have been the consequences for you and I as investors in, who invest with these fund managers, or even like your ordinary retail investor, like who pegs around and buys property shares. Can you just like wrap it up for us?
Yeah, certainly. So the resilient group of companies that we refer to have a common founding and often a common driving shareholder and directors. Certainly, Des de Beer was the founder of the original Resilient Group. That listed property company has given birth to other companies. And at the moment, when we talk about the Resilient Stable or the Resilient Group, we're referring to four listed property companies, which include Resilient, Nepi Rockcastle, Fortress, and Green Bay Properties. Those were a substantial part of the South African property index at the start of the year. They accounted for as much as 40% of the index. So anyone with savings and exposure to the listed property index would have been a shareholder, either directly or indirectly, in those group of companies. And what's transpired is that certainly going back as many over 10 years ago, via allegations made in these anonymous and so-called Limpopo memos, which alleged that some of the executives, including Des de Beer, had been conducting related party transactions which enriched them at the expense of shareholders in the companies. And more recently, this year, we had the leaked report from 361 Asset Management, which alleged that the shares of the four companies had been manipulated in part by subsidiaries of the companies themselves, by its B shareholding vehicle, the Siyaka Trusts, as well as very kind of strange entities with links to some of the directors. And that ultimately led to the Financial Services Conduct Authority instituting investigations into the dealings in the shares in March. We have an ongoing investigation by the Hawks into those transactions described in the Limpopo memos. And so I think part of the reason that the institutional investors wrote the letters, they said, look, guys, you're such a big part of this index. I mean, we can choose not to own the shares in the companies, but you know, for the sake of the industry itself, which is a very large component of our equity market, we want these issues resolved. It's to no one's benefit to have these clouds over the companies, and part of the reason is they've requested this very specific action is the companies have instituted investigations themselves. But they've deemed that some of the findings and the scope of these investigations have questions over how were the scope wide enough, and was the investigations undertaken by the people that they've appointed, like the likes of which included the country's previous auditor general, Shaked Fakhi, have they been independent enough? And that has not, in their view, resolved the issue. And so many investors would want this issue resolved because of the large proportion that these listed companies occupy in our listed property space.
Well, just to give the listener a scope of what are the kind of like the numbers we're dealing with here. I mean, looking at the share price of this resilient group, I think like from cumulatively, we've seen investors basically lose what 130 billion rand in 6 months. Put that into context, we have the SARS commission at the moment, which is basically investigating what happened in SARS, and one of the consequences of what happened at SARS was a loss of or a shortfall in 50 billion rand in revenue. So this is actually in theory or in paper terms, the investors in these companies have lost twice as much as that. And the only thing is a bit of a shock that it's only taken this long for people, as you said, that these big companies to get involved, and the fact that the regulators don't seem to actually be playing ball. I mean, they say they're investigating, but we haven't really heard anything of any note from them, have we?
Absolutely. I think part of the problem that we've certainly seen in terms of the state capture in the public sector, Lucanio, is that the abilities of our enforcement agencies were severely compromised during the tenure of President Zuma. And that has meant that in many cases, I think, in my personal opinion, we lack the ability to investigate and prosecute sophisticated white-collar crime as well. And part of the problem, I think, as well, is that enforcement agencies have to be very sure of the allegations, and that certainly does take time. So the question is, you know, does the country still have the ability to investigate sophisticated white-collar crime? Well, I'm probably not sure that we do. And then added to the fact is that you've also got, you know, the issue of some of the findings of the independent review, which have not been sufficient in scope. So this is all kind of leads to this malaise and degradation in corporate governance, both in the public sector and the private sector, that I think we've seen during the Zuma era and that we're now trying to deal with. I mean, that is a staggering amount. As you pointed out, those companies' values have declined by, between the four of them, 120 billion rand since the start of the year. It has dragged the performance of the property index down by year to date by 23%. And as we saw yesterday, with Norbert Sass, the CEO of Growthpoint, one of the country's biggest listed property companies. He made the comments that the allegations and the ongoing controversy around these companies has affected the listed property index as a whole. Now, part of the problem, I think, when we look at the institutional investors and we say, well, why haven't you acted faster than this? Why has it taken so long? Their response has been that certainly there should be safeguards in place to certainly deal with these issues. They point to things like the auditors. Where do the auditors stand in this? Where do the company sponsors? Why haven't the company sponsors raised some of these issues? That's the company that they use to interact with the stock exchange. Where are the boards of these companies that should be the first line of defense in terms of the corporate governance? And so eventually it lands on the lap of the institutional investors. And I understand their argument from one perspective that there are these safeguards in place that should deal with it.
I mean, obviously, like you mentioned, the boards, that should be on the forefront. I mean, I think for most people in this country would be quite taken aback or perplexed by the issues with Steinhoff. I mean, yesterday you have the CFO saying, it wasn't me, I didn't know. And I mean, the question that comes to my mind, the title is Chief Financial Officer. So if the Chief Financial Officer says he doesn't know and somebody else should have told him, how do you add up together? And then also the Steinhoff thing, you mentioned the boards should be on the forefront. I mean, you've got the former chairman who signed up all the accounts, not only saying like, it wasn't me, he's actually suing the company, saying I'm a victim too. I mean, as an ordinary saver out there, how should you respond to this when you see this and you see this guy is still there and actually making these kind of excuses?
Certainly, you wonder, but I think one of the things, and maybe it isn't dealt with in some of the corporate governance material guidelines provided by the likes of King, is that the common denominator I see in the two companies at Steinhoff, you had Markus Juster, the CEO, has been involved and has built the company up over 30 years. The cult of personality, where he could tell a more junior CFO, a man about 14 years younger than him, that he himself would manage the oversight of the European division, which is where all these problems around the accounting irregularities have surfaced, and that CFO, either lacking the stature or the resolve to stand up to him and say, but Markus, I need to be able to look at these accounts. It's my role. It's my duty. I cannot be the CFO of the group and not have oversight of the European accounts, which is what Ben Lakrunji was telling us yesterday, which at the very least, in my opinion, is negligence. At the same time, you've got a driving force like Des de Beer at Resilient, who has a serial entrepreneur and a great record in starting various listed companies. He was one of the first to buy and develop shopping malls in townships and rural areas. He was one of the first to go into Eastern Europe, if not the first to go into Eastern Europe and buy property there. Driving force behind the company and the wealth and the growth in these companies. And perhaps what you're lacking inside the management teams and at these boards is people with sufficient stature to question this man who's founded all these companies in the same way that Juster was the driving force at Steinhoff. And maybe that's another question that we need to examine more closely, is like, how do you deal with a cult of personality? Would someone, for instance, stand up to Steve Jobs at Apple and if he was doing something untoward and say, yeah, Steve, hold on, we need to investigate, we need to understand this properly. What is going on here? Maybe that's a question for the corporate governance experts to answer, though.
I mean, that's interesting as well. I mean, you talk about that when you have these founder leaders, this like whose identity becomes intertwined with the company. But then you have, it's not the first case of you've had companies like that. I mean, you have a company like, say, like Investec, that's like very much intertwined with Stephen Kosoff, but there's never been any suggestion that it was not governed properly because of his personality. So I suppose like it's a question. I don't know whether is it to do with individual companies or is this something structural?
I would suspect that certainly there's personalities at play here, but at some point I think the appointment of directors on boards is perhaps still not objective enough, And you know, it's a bit contradictory though, because certainly at Steinhoff we had guys like Johan van Sale and Steve Boysen, who I would say are no shrinking violets, still being either misled by or overpowered by Uster in the boardroom regarding transactions that they had undertaken, or some of the year-end entries where Steve Boysen was the chair of the audit committee. Was there a big strong personality on the boards of Resilient, Fortress, Nepi Rockcastle, asking what is going on here and why haven't we resolved the issues that have continued to plague the company? It could be, a combination of both. Mm. Perhaps in the one case, in Resilient's case, insufficient strength on the board to challenge these driving personalities, the cult of personality, and perhaps in other instances, maybe just perhaps the personality that was able to bamboozle things through the board.
Mm. Just for the sake of transparency and fairness, can we just go back again to the Resilient Group and just explain to people what exactly is being investigated and who's charged with what? For example, on the whole issue of insider trading, I think it's important now to clarify. The FCA, the authorities are not necessarily investigating the BAR or any of the directors for insider trading, but they're investigating trading in those company shares. Is that an accurate description?
Yes, I think that they trade. So the way I understand it is that they're investigating the trading in the shares, one, to see if they were deliberately manipulating the share price. But I think there is an element that they will be looking at, certainly with some of the associates and some of these funny companies that we saw on the shareholder register of these companies. If, for instance, in the case of this Mr. Oberholzer, who has no apparent experience in financial markets, he is the director and, by one version, the sole shareholder of companies that owned over R1 billion worth of stock in the Resilient Group of companies. So you ask yourself, well, who is this man and how did he generate his wealth? Because certainly from the investigations that we did, his lifestyle does not seem to indicate that he has the means to invest or access over a billion rand to invest in just these four companies. So you kind of say, well, perhaps is he fronting for someone? And that would certainly form part of the component that the FSCA would be looking into, and perhaps establishing whether Mr. Oberholzer was acting on behalf of directors or insiders in the company. So insider trading will be part of the broader investigation that they're doing into the trading of the shares in the companies, as I understand it.
Well, and I mean, since President Ramaphosa came over and took over, it's been, there was some initial optimism. I know he came out there and he said like he wants to boost the economy, he wants to double the growth rate, more than double to 3%. Obviously, we're not going to get there. And one of the things he wanted to do was to go out there, have these people come out, you know, like all these big names from Trevor Manuel to Yaku Mare, to go out and try and attract investment into the country. These scandals, these headlines, how much are they hurting the country? How much are they hurting the reputation of not only just of the country, but of our private sector as recipients of potential investment?
Absolutely. I think to Mr. Ramaphosa's credit, the various commissions that are underway at the moment are certainly lifting the lid on what and how state capture occurred under President Zuma's tenure. So I think that's very positive. I think what's also very positive is that the boards of some of the key state-owned entities have been filled with people with integrity and with a desire to right the situation. And I'm talking most notably there about Eskom, the appointment of Jabu Mabuza as chairman has been very positive. But at the same time, the factional nature of the ANC at the moment has brought the issue of expropriation without compensation to the table. And I don't think discussing the issue is the problem. I just think the reckless and rather spontaneous way in which it's been raised, without the due process that the ANC usually applies to significant policy changes, has been more worrisome for investors. And certainly speaking to the people working inside that presidential investment program. There is a pull and a tug here. On the one hand, you've got these envoys and a president determined to raise new investment. On the other hand, you've got this what looks to be a rather irresponsible way to discuss or raise or process the issue of expropriation without compensation. And that, I feel, is the overarching influence in this situation. And that's why while we can certainly compliment the president on his efforts, without the responsible resolution and development of a policy towards expropriation without compensation, I don't feel we're going to raise the money that we so desperately need to drive growth in the economy.
Yeah, I mean, especially on that issue of land. I mean, expropriation actually is always been there. It's like it's something not always been there, but it's something that they've always been able to do. Like, there's nothing actually in the current legislative framework or in, even in the constitution that stops expropriation without compensation. And obviously, like when Sunday, like there's talk about changing the constitution, without to make it somehow easier, without actually explaining to people how it actually has made it difficult in the first place. Obviously, that raises questions. I mean, for me personally, anyway, because I'm a bit idealistic in the sense I think the constitution is a supreme law, and I think you don't mess that with that unless you really, really have to. And they haven't really told me or shown me any evidence that they really have to in this case.
Exactly, and I think the other thing is, I mean, the way we kind of look at the land issues. In two ways, a restitutive nature, which is giving back land to people that the land was stolen from, which I think everyone agrees needs to happen and can happen under the current constitutional framework that we have. And then the issue around transformation in agriculture, which we also broke the news about regarding the land bank, saying that there are unintended consequences of expropriating without compensation. In the event where we have lent money to farmers and the land is taken away, not only their means of production is taken away, but the collateral to loans that we have extended to those farmers then could trigger a whole series of default clauses, which could result in the entire land bank, the entire $41 billion in funding the land bank receives from outside investors being called upon, which would eventually lead to a bailout by the state, a huge bailout by the state. So I think it's just that the process is just, it seems to be helter-skelter and didn't follow a due process inside the ANC as well, with the development of white papers by think tanks and policy wonks. And I think that's what investors are saying, this seems to have cropped up more as a means of helping the ANC potentially win the election next year, less than being a measured and well thought through process of how we get transformation happening in land and how we give land back to people that have been displaced and dispossessed of it in the past.
That's really quite an interesting discussion, and I should probably let our readers know that one of our reporters, Teto, is actually out doing case studies at the moment up there in Mpumalanga, I think. So hopefully when she gets back, we will be able to have some, maybe she'll be sitting in this desk here and telling us what people out there are saying about this land issue. But I think I suppose just to wrap up, let's go back to our original idea, our point. I mean, I think to wrap up for us, it's been really an illuminating week, especially from the private sector of things, because people have, you know, when you come to people who talk about corruption, talk about mismanagement, people think about the state. It's very rare that they think about the public sector. So I think maybe they might have taken longer to get there, longer than they should have maybe, but maybe our fund managers do deserve a pat on the back for putting this on the national consciousness that actually we are talking about wrongdoing in the private sector and the need to deal with it in a public and transparent way.
Absolutely. I've been saying that for a while now, that the private sector is about 18 months behind where the public sector is in terms of lifting the lid on corruption, on corporate governance failures. I don't really see there's been any sector in South Africa that appears to have been unaffected by what's happened, and it's vital that the private sector deals with its own issues, which are just as serious as some of the issues and just as harmful to the public in terms of our prosperity, our ability to attract investment, as the public sector is. So I think there's still a lot more work to do, and I'm sure Business Day will be at the front of that.
Warren, thank you very much. Thank you for your time, and thank you for your reporting, and still continue doing it, and hopefully it will inspire more people to come forward.
Thank you.